Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from Real Ghost Stories Online, inviting you to subscribe to our other podcast called The Grave Talks. It's where I sit down and interview individuals who've had extreme paranormal situations happen to them in their lives. Just search The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe and give us some stars to help spread the word that this show exists. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of The Grave Talks. Today on The Grave Talks, White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. On Christmas Day 1929, the lives of an entire family came to an end. After eating Christmas lunch, Charlie Lawson murdered his entire family. Shotguns, rifles, and bodies bludgeoned with blunt objects were all found amongst the carnage of this horrific murder scene on Christmas Day. These events would shock and disturb everyone in the community, leaving them with more questions than answers. What led this man to take the lives of his supposed loved ones on a day that was typically reserved for family and celebration? Was there something dark at play that drove Charlie to perform such a despicable act? Today, we discuss White Christmas, Bloody Christmas with author of that very book, Trudy J. Smith.
People probably need to realize that there's actually two books that I wrote on this case. The first one was a result of my father's interest in the case. He was 8 years old when the murders happened. And he remembered it very well and how it affected him that day, that Christmas morning or afternoon, when word came, you know, that this terrible tragedy had happened, you know, about an hour drive away from where he lived in Thomasville. And he was fascinated by this story and bothered by it his entire life. And I remember him taking us, you know, we had gone on a trip up to the mountains. You know, it's something here in North Carolina a lot of people living in the Piedmont did back then. And it's in the foothills where this story happened. And he brought us back by and showed us where the murders had happened. At that time, I was about 6 years old. And the Lawson cabin was still there. And I remember we drove up. And I could see the cabin. I wasn't overly interested in it, but I do remember seeing it standing out in the sunlight and the sagebrush. And it had, it was being used for hay storage. And so that day we couldn't go in it and look at it or anything. But anyhow, it just shows he had an interest all the time, all through my life. He would bring it up and talk about it. And, nobody really could understand what happened, what caused this man to kill his entire family on Christmas Day. It was just not something that happened as much maybe as it does now, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, he continued that interest. And when he retired at about age 65, he was still thinking about it, and he had developed some friends that lived up there in the area, and you know, of the murders, and you know, they would talk about it. It was a topic of conversation, you know, for two or three generations there. People would talk about it, and someone that he knew said, "Well, I know Charlie Lawson's best friend." They lived right there and worked with him, knew him. And my father was just very excited. He said, "Well, can I meet this person?" That person's name was Hillary Hampton. They called him Hill Hampton. And so my father met with him and got to talk to him and learned a lot, you know, from Hill Hampton about the Lawsons and how he knew them and everything. And one thing of note, it didn't stand out so much really then as to what it was going to end up being. But Hill Hampton told my father that first time he spoke with him that there was a problem in the family, and he knew what it was, but he didn't think it was his place to say anything about it or to tell anybody about it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuck in my father's head, you know, what is he talking about? And it wasn't too long after that, you know, that stirred my father's interest up, and one thing led to another almost kind of magically. He ended up with a few pictures, and they were hard to come by. And so we went, well, he came back and talked to me about it, and he said, I'd like for you to go up there to that graveyard with me and look at the graves. And, you know, this is a family graveyard back in the woods with this mass grave and a large headstone and everything. And I said, well, that'll be interesting. You know, I'd love to go up there and see it with you. So we went up there, and I think the year was 1987, if I'm not mistaken. And we were looking at the tombstone. It was like a really dreary, rainy day. We were standing under an umbrella together. And I was reading the epitaph on the tombstone. And that tombstone says, not now, but in the coming years, it will be in a better land. We'll read the meaning of our tears, and then sometime we'll understand. And that just really struck me. I thought, that's a strange epitaph, and that it said that we'll read the meaning of our tears. Mm-hmm. And I asked my father, I said, has anybody ever tried to write a book about this? And he said, no. As I understand it, they'll try to kill you. The family will try to kill you if you try to write anything about it. I said, wow. I mean, you know.
Quite a warning.
Yeah. And they said, you know, some people tried it and were scared off of writing it. At that time in the late 80s, the murder was about 60 years old. And all the people that knew much of anything about it were now in their, you know, 80s or older. So at least 70s, you know.
Sure.
And I said, well, you know, I don't see any reason why anybody would be left that would be that opposed, you know, in this day and age of true crimes being written and that type of thing. And I was one of those people who didn't have money to go to college when I was young, but I had just gone back to college, and a lot of my teachers were telling me that I was a gifted writer, this type of thing, you know, mm-hmm. a scholarly writer, I should consider writing, you know, that type of thing. And that really bolstered my confidence that maybe I could pull it off.
Sure.
And I said, well, you know what? You know, I was working, had a child. I said, I'm not going to be able to research this, but if you wanted to try to write a book and let's do it together, then we'll try it. And I said, you know, but you'd have to pull together interviews, talk to people, and bring me back everything, and find any pictures you can find and that type of thing. And I said, well, you know, if it's meant to be, it'll be done, and we'll do it. And if it's not meant to be, then we'll fail. But it's okay. You know, we'll just put one foot in front of the other and, you know, see what we come up about the story.
Sure.
And so that's kind of how it started. That book ended up being White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. And a lot of people know of that book and don't know about the subsequent book that I wrote that's much more enlarged. White Christmas, Bloody Christmas, it tried to sell. I mean, I didn't ever expect it to be a national bestseller. I mean, you know, we were doing it for the area, regional. But I remember having to argue with the first printing company that printed that book. And I had ordered 2,500 copies, and the president of that little printing company sat down with me and said, "Oh, you'll never sell these. You shouldn't print so many," and on and on and on, and just was really insulting almost. And I told him, I said, his name was Mr. Hall. I said, "Mr. Hall, let me ask you something. I said, if I print these books and I pay you for it," it was fairly expensive for us to do this too, "and I pay you for it, and they sit in my living room for the next 100 years, will it be of any concern to you?" Well, long story short, we printed them. Much problems in printing that first printing. I mean, that printing company really messed things up. That's a story I could write a book about almost in itself. But anyhow, long story short, we got the 2,500 copies finally, and a newspaper article was written about the book coming out, and we had it as a consignment thing in a local bookstore in High Point the first time that it was sold. Well, people lined up, like, you know, hundreds at that little bookstore. And we had sold all 2,500 copies within 3 weeks.
Wow.
It's amazing. It was trying to sell like a bestseller, even though it was originally produced book.
Sure.
And anyhow, we went to a regular book printer, commercial book printer, and had subsequent runs of it done. And there was about, with overruns, it's probably close to 14,000 copies were done. I had a lot of trouble, you know, with selling it. I could write a book about everything that went
sure.
on. But anyhow, we had it printed more times, and as it was printed and more people got the book and read it and everything, then more and more information came to us after that first publication. It was like, wow, there's more here. More people know things. More people know somebody that could be interviewed, et cetera, et cetera. But I had so much trouble with this book, and we did get death threats and threats to be sued and all of that. And we sold that book completely through within about the first 3 or 4 years, every copy we had. Now, you have to keep in mind that most books don't sell. Well, I had a professor tell me there was probably 50,000 books produced that year in 1990 or published, and only about 4% of them would ever in the history of the life of the book sell beyond 5,000 copies. And we eventually sold close to 14,000 in that 4 years.
Wow.
And so it actually put White Christmas, Bloody Christmas up in, you know, the top 4 or 5% of all books published that year as far as sales.
Sure.
With that statistic, if that guy was right, hopefully he was. He was a teacher, you know, of publishing and mm-hmm. writing.
Go
ahead.
It's very compelling. I mean, and I want to jump into what sort of information you received from the public after you published it. I want to talk more about just some of the difficulties you encountered. But before we even get to that point, let's fill the audience in a bit on what happened on that Christmas day where the family was murdered. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll dive into more of what information started to come out, what you discovered. But let's establish uh-huh. that first, because it sounds obviously very, very, you know, intriguing as to how this whole family mm-hmm. was killed. Factually, what happened on that Christmas day to the Lawson family?
Okay. Charlie Lawson They called him Charlie. His name was Charles Davis Lawson. He was a tobacco farmer, just rural tobacco farmer in the foothills of North Carolina. And he was typical for that area. They were just outside of Winston-Salem, sold their tobaccos. Many people, neighbors around there did. On Christmas Day in 1929, he, out of the blue, on that day, right after lunch, murdered his entire family, including his wife and all of his children. And the oldest child was 17. The youngest was 3 months. And it just took the world by the heart. That he could do this, including my father, as we were talking about before, mm-hmm. That a father could murder his whole family like that, and not only murder them, but choose Christmas Day.
I hope you enjoyed your 15-minute preview of our new podcast, The Grave Talks. Be sure to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download podcasts to not miss any episode of the show. New episodes every single Monday. Just search for The Grave Talks. And then press subscribe. Give us a review while you're at it and some stars that will help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that the show exists to make an even better show for you. The Grave Talks. Check it out at thegravetalks.com.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.